Lizzie O'Leary, and this is your Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of September 5th, 2014. I have a confession to make. When I took Economics 101 in college, I was not always fully awake. The class was at 8 a.m., and my attendance was often dependent on sleep, weather, and coffee. So it took me a while to learn that economics is really a collection of human behaviors. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with your everyday life. Our show this week is all about control, how we try to control the sometimes scary world around us through our purchases or our responses to something unpredictable, something as seemingly disconnected as spending money to pamper your pet can really be about creating a nice, safe moment in the world. Perhaps if I'd exercised a little more self-control and gone to class, I would have learned that earlier. As always, come share your stories of how you seize a little everyday control on MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace, WKND. Now let's round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
U.S. District Court finding BP grossly negligent in the 2010 Gulf of Mexico Macondo oil spill.
It's a disappointment, a big one. The economy only added, guys, 142,000 jobs during the month of August.
53 million Americans are freelancers. That's 34% of the national workforce, or the combined total population of 25 states.
Thinking about workers, if you are a regular American worker, you probably have a little control over how much money you make. You try to do your best at work, but in the end, you don't have all that much control. And that brings us to our top story. The vast majority of U.S. workers have had little to no wage growth since the 1970s. Yep, really. Those numbers were so stunning that when you heard Marketplace's Chrissy Clark report them, hundreds of you wrote in. So we brought her back. Chrissy's the senior reporter for Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Wage growth is basically in the same place where it was in the 1970s. That's the headline here. I want to start off by listening to a character from your story. Why don't you set this up for us?
So I spoke with a gentleman named Jamad Reed. He's 26 years old. He got a job a few years ago as a cashier at Walmart near Cincinnati. And in the last couple years, he has gotten a couple raises, but the raises have not been very big ones. You know, they've barely kept up with inflation. He started at $8.15 an hour. Now, 2 years later, he's making $9.05 an hour. So not even a dollar raise in two years. And when I asked him about what that was like, here's what he said.
I'm stuck. You know what I'm saying? I feel like I'm stuck in the same spot.
That sense of being stuck, that seems to resonate with people all over the economic spectrum and with researchers who looked at this phenomenon. Why is it happening? Do we know?
This was one of the debates that economists are having around sort of these larger shifts going on in our economy. And some people point to the fact that, you know, especially coming out of the recession, there's this really slack labor market. We have a lot more people who want jobs than we have jobs to fill. And so what that means is workers don't have a lot of leverage. If they ask for a raise and the boss says no, it's kind of like, well, okay,
tough.
Okay,
yeah.
Because otherwise there are four guys waiting outside who want my same job for whatever wage.
Your story provoked really strong responses online among listeners. I looked at a Reddit page where there were hundreds and hundreds of comments about your story. One of them was very interesting, and it raised the question of this increase in productivity and the tension of whether that was about technological advances like email and computers or whether it was about a slack labor market and employers who were nervous about paying more money because we're still in this squishy place where, you know, employers don't want to hire more people just yet or don't want to pay more just yet.
Productivity is growing for a lot of reasons. One is that we are in the midst of a technological revolution. And so, you know, one robot can do what a bunch of people once had to do. And so that means that you can be more efficient. That also means that there are fewer jobs, and especially fewer middle-income jobs, because those are a lot of the jobs that are being replaced by automation. So that means that you have a lot of folks who are getting lower wage jobs because that's one of the few places where the economy is growing. So that's one reason why wages are stagnating. There's also globalization. You know, a lot of things are being offshored or outsourced that were once done in the U.S. So in general, we have this hollowing out of middle wage jobs, which means that on average, median wages are going to be lower, or, you know, aren't going to be rising as quickly as they once did.
We got one question on the Marketplace website about Jamaad Reed at the top of your story. And they wrote in asking, did Mr. Reed finish high school? Is he motivated? Saying motivation and desire, if you don't have it, you're done. I'd like your take on that.
Well, the simple answer is yes, he did finish high school. And he started going to college and couldn't pay the bills. And so he has a lot of student debt that he's struggling with right now. He's still trying to take some college classes, sort of juggling them with his work schedule. So this isn't just a story of very low income, low skilled workers who are not seeing their wages grow in real terms. This is true up and down the economic spectrum. It's true for people, for high school dropouts, for people who are in the midst of their college careers. What once was fairly common in the U.S., where even if you stayed at the same level, you would get cost of living increases every couple of years that would keep you in pace with inflation.
Chrissy Clark is a senior reporter for Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk. Thank you so much, Chrissy.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We want to talk now about Ebola. The current outbreak in West Africa is the worst on record and feels as if it is out of control. More than 3,500 people have contracted the illness. More than 2,000 have died. It's also meant profound changes to everyday life. Curfews, containment zones, a near halt to the agricultural production and mining that are staples of the region's economy. Balmed Holdings buys and sells cocoa, coffee, and cashews in Sierra Leone. They have more than 50 employees, and they work with thousands of local farmers. Medgar Brown is the CEO of Balmed, and he joins us over the phone from Freetown, Sierra Leone. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
How are you doing?
Can you describe what Freetown is like for me right now?
Freetown at the moment is obviously going through a very stressful time. Everybody is on high alert, trying their very best to stay at arm's length from each other. And very little activities are going on in terms of business. It's a bit of a stressful time at the moment.
My understanding is that several of your farms are in the main quarantine and containment areas that are essentially under government control right now. How is that affecting your business?
It's virtually put the business at a standstill. Most of the areas where we're buying cocoa from is under quarantine at the moment. And that's the eastern part of the country in Kalan District mainly, and Kenema. So yes, we are not actually operating at the moment. We've got about 1,000 acres worth of seedlings sat around at the moment where we cannot outplant. And we're not the only traders. There are other traders that are experiencing the same problems. There are some traders which are trying to do some sort of buying. But for us, it's pretty much a standstill.
Are you able to know if the people you are working with are sick or are affected?
Yes, we are in regular contact with our farmers. In those areas where we have communications, in an area called Boidu, very close to Koindu, where the whole thing started from, where it came down from the Guinea axis, we've got, I think now, two farmers that have actually died from Ebola that we know of. And the other areas that we're working in Kailaun, most of those areas now are affected by Ebola.
Sierra Leone has been through so much, and businesses like yours have been a way for a lot of people to get their economic feet under them. I wonder what you think about the effect that Ebola is going to have economically going forward on a country that has finally moved forward from a lot of strife.
Well, I would say it's going to be catastrophic. I think it's going to take a long time for recovery to kick back in. And in some senses, it probably might even be worse than the war effect, because it's spreading rapidly at the moment and everything's at a standstill and we don't know when it's going to end.
Does it feel hard to run a business when people are worried about their lives, their children, on a day-to-day level?
Oh, for sure. We need these people to work. They need to work so they can have an income, or we need to run a business. And when you're doing agriculture, it's pretty much a joint thing. So, it's very distressing if people can't go to work and earn a living, but having to go to work in fear, or not even go to work at all.
Are you even able to pay the people who work for you right now?
So far, we've been able to keep them paid, even though they're not going to work, because obviously they would need some sort of money coming in from somewhere. So far, everybody that's working for us is fully paid. So that will at least help them in their situation. And we're also trying to link with the NGOs that we have been working with for some time to see how best we can facilitate getting food to farmers in the field, helping the NGOs with some surveys, because these are the areas which we're working in. So we're doing the best that we can to assist under the circumstances.
How long do you think you can stay in business in this way?
I don't think that we can go on for perhaps another 2 months, maybe. And then maybe we'll cut the salary down to half. And then we'll get to the point where we probably have to stop. But it's, we're running into the ground if we're just paying people for sitting around doing nothing. Yeah, so it's not going to go on for much longer, I don't think, for us anyway.
How are you holding up emotionally?
Well, I'm actually sitting in Freetown, which is the capital, as you may know. And, it's not easy.
Medgar Brown, CEO of Balmed, thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Stay tuned for more Marketplace Weekend, coming up after the break.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. It's a cliche we know you've heard before. Money can't buy you love. But what if it could help you show your love? And I mean, you actually doled out money to your family and the amounts varied based on how much you loved them. Well, that's exactly what happens in this story. From Los Angeles-based writer Joey Slayman.
I was born in 1982, and for four short, wonderful years, I was my grandmother's favorite. My grandma, or Sito as we called her, had three children, but only one son, my father. And in the Syrian culture, men reign supreme. Maybe not even the Syrian culture anymore, but definitely in the old school mentality my Sito had. Women were to serve men, and men were to provide. And since my father was a doctor, well, you could burn your retinas on the pride she'd beam. So to be the only child of her only son, I was set. It was a given that I'd be her favorite grandchild, and life was good. Until my brother was born. Everyone loves my brother more than me, to this day. But from the second he was born, it was clear that with my Sito, I was old news. Her son had a son, and she could not have loved him more. hard when you're a child of around six to realize that someone doesn't love you as much as they love someone else, especially when that someone is your own grandmother and that someone else is this annoying little attention-grabbing thing that kind of looked like me. But I wasn't worried. Surely she'd have to see that I was the superior grandchild and more deserving of her love and praise than my stupid brother, who couldn't even stand up on his own. But my efforts went unnoticed. There is photographic proof of my grandmother's love of my brother over me. In every photo of the three of us, she's practically pushing me out of the frame so she can make room for her more beloved grandson. This happened for years. One morning while visiting her in Pennsylvania, she made this huge Syrian breakfast, and there were three dishes on the dining room table. After coming back with a run from my father, I was starving, and I sat down in one of the place settings. And you know what my sitter said? "Oh, are you hungry? I think there's cereal in the pantry." Yeah. She had made breakfast for my father, my brother, and herself, so she could be surrounded with the ones she truly loved. I had to stand in the kitchen with my mother while we quietly ate old Weetabix, and my mother promised me a trip to Dunkin' Donuts later to make up for it. But it didn't matter. I knew that deep down, she loved me as much as she loved my brother. I knew this for a fact, because every Christmas, we'd each get a crisp $50 bill from my sitto. My other grandmother wrote checks, but my sitto sent cash. She could dote over him and all but ignore me to her house in front of our other family members, but here was cold, hard proof that at the end of the day, my brother and I were the same, each deserving of the same $50 bill. When she passed away years later, we were looking through some of her old belongings, and that's when I saw it, the ledger. My sitto ran a cigarette and candy shop, which was an actual thing in the 70s. And she was always a meticulous accountant. I never saw her pay for anything without writing down the exact amount to be officially recorded later. And going through her old money ledger, my heart welled with pride. This woman, who did so much for everyone around her, managed to stay independent even after the loss of her husband and due to her meticulous finances. And good for her. To hell with men. We can be just as smart and capable with money. I vowed then and there to be as diligent with my own finances as an ode to my sitto, to run my own life and never let anyone tell me I was less than. And then I saw it. December 15th, 1997. The entries for the Christmas presents for her grandchildren. My brother's name, Matthew, and next to it, $50. And then I saw my name, Joey, $25. I was shocked and immediately went to my mother, hoping she would explain it away as some mistake. Then my sitto obviously loved us both the same, and there's no way she would give my brother double what she'd given me. That I hadn't been living a lie for the past 17 years, and that the secret confirmation I always had that my grandmother loved me just as much as my brother was simply recorded wrong in the ledger. My mother sighed and said, "That's why you got cash. She always sent checks, but I had to make up the difference." "You two always got the same from me," my mother added in an attempt to save my dignity. It did not work. I was crushed. But maybe this is why the gender wage gap doesn't bother me. At least it's not 50% like my grandmother's.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. Now let's talk about some of the other economic stories going on. And it's the weekend. So let's have brunch. We are out having brunch at the Pullman Kitchen on 2nd Avenue, and I am joined today by Nicholas Carlson from Business Insider and Ben Walsh from the Huffington Post. Welcome to you both.
Hello. How are you?
Thank you.
So, guys, I want to start with the big rollout, this year's build-up, hyped press event. Apple. Here we go. It's coming.
The iPhone 6.
Take it away, Carlson. What do they got? What are we on the hook for to hype this year, man?
So the big things are there's going to be two new iPhones. There's going to be a 4.5-inch one and a 5.5-inch one, Apple's, and then also an iWatch, which is really exciting. And there might even be two screen sizes for those, too. But Apple's finally getting in the phablet business, one of these, like...
Phablet?
It's not a phone. It's not a tablet. It's a fact.
That is a ridiculous word.
But it's a very fast-growing segment of the market.
I'm sorry. I cannot take anything seriously that is called a phablet.
Consumers do, though. Basically, people want cheaper phones and bigger phones. And Apple, to date, has made neither of those.
In the context of this week where we have seen celebrities' naked pictures get hacked, show up on the internet, and it's
obviously debatable how that happened and whose security flaws are to blame, but the public is thinking about privacy and talking about privacy. Is there an extra onus on companies now to demonstrate that your stuff is private?
Well, people are blaming Apple for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're blaming. And it's interesting. Apple supposedly is going to be announcing a new payment system with the new phone. So you can just sort of, like you can at Starbucks already, sort of wave your phone at the counter and pay instead of a credit card. I've never really seen why credit cards need replacing. They seem to be pretty efficient and useful to me. But are people going to, you know, now that they've seen, you know, naked pictures of Jennifer Lawrence, are they going to sort of say, oh, I'm going to trust Apple with my bank account?
The other thing is that banks themselves aren't necessarily super secure. JP Morgan has been dealing with a potentially state-sponsored Russian hack.
Russian hack, yeah.
Which it's sort of weird to think about a bank this way, but at this point we need to, is that these are finance companies. They're also multi-billion dollar technology companies. And when they are compromised in even a slight way, there are hundreds of billions of dollars at risk.
Sure. It's in this world of like the NSA, and you can't assume that your emails are private. And I just think that like if you were going to live your life concerned about privacy and security to the utmost, you just wouldn't be able to live the normal American life, or you just would live a very cloister. You just wouldn't be able to participate in society anymore.
I want to talk about a post-recession piece of data that came out that is really interesting to me from the Fed that basically says the gap between rich and poor America widened. But we're not talking about the recession. We're talking about the recovery, where the income of the richest 10% went up by 10%, and families in the bottom 40% saw their income go down over, you know, 2010 to 2013. That was the recovery.
Yeah.
What does that mean for normal people?
You know, when I think about the recovery, I think a lot about it. It was an asset recovery. The stock market has been great since 2009. The housing market has recovered a lot. But if you look at that article, it says
the article in the Wall Street Journal. Yeah.
The article says that like the percentage of ownership of assets has really declined. So like people who don't own anything besides, you know, they're just getting their paycheck and paying their rent or things like that, they're not invested in anything. They haven't benefited from any sort of recovery at all.
It could also have help people by preventing things from being worse than they were.
Right.
So there's no, to use geeky language, there's no null case here that we can test against not having done QE.
Preventing a negative is really hard to explain.
Exactly. But I think there is a strong case, what Nick said, basically, that this has been an asset-based recovery. The kind of rate of increase of GDP and wage growth has just not been there in the last couple of years, but the stock market has been on a tear, and so have housing prices. And the wealthiest Americans both own those things, and then also a lot of times their incomes are tied to the performance of those assets, whether it's working in the financial sector or simply just receiving the income from assets that they've already invested.
Can you think of anything that would change that picture?
You'd have to see broad-based wage growth in the kind of mid-hourly workers.
Right.
So people who make between, call it $15 and $30 an hour, if all of a sudden they were making between $20 and $35 an hour, that would be a significant change.
We could have like a massive, massive philosophical change about what companies and corporations are supposed to do. And so sort of in Asia, there's more constituents to what a corporation should do. It should take care of its employees, it should take care of its customers, and it should take care of its shareholders. Here, it's just all about the shareholders. And so that just means profit growth and keeping wages as low as possible and sort of...
Which just helps wealthy people who already own stock.
Exactly. It helps the people who own these assets.
The dividing line and the kind of the catchphrase for the division that Nick is talking about is shareholder capitalism versus stakeholder capitalism. And so the idea is that, you know, American companies basically pretty much without fail look to do good by their shareholders, which means an increasing stock price and paying cash back in the form of dividends or buying back stock. Other companies in Europe and Asia have this kind of broader view, and they look at what are called stakeholders, which is, you know, pretty much everybody who touches the company in almost any way, including and especially employees and customers.
Next week, we're taking the show on the road, and Ben Walsh is coming with us. Thanks to you both, Nicholas Carlson, Chief Correspondent for Business Insider, and Ben Walsh, Money and Finance Reporter for The Huffington Post.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM.
every day you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
The Battle of the Bulges. And here are some of the latest mechanized units on maneuvers, or rather, womaneuvers.
This is Tech in Real Life.
I'm here with Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Lizzie, how are you?
I'm all right. We're here in a park in New York. It's very nice out.
It's beautiful. Let me just throw out a couple names at you and see what this makes you think of. Kathy Smith's Air Bench and Power Step Workout, or Denise Austin Tone Up 123, Slide Reebok, the Lifeline Gym,
yeah.
The Shake Weight.
Oh, I know the Shake Weight, but yeah, I don't know what half of those things are.
Okay, they're all workout machines and systems from the last decade.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was a Bowflex guy myself. I don't look like the Bowflex guy, but I have dabbled.
But that fits into what we're doing today.
Yeah.
Tell us what we're doing.
We're going to take a look at how tech is going to actually maybe help us get a little more fit.
All right, so there is a boom in fitness apps going on right now.
Yes.
Explain to me what's going on.
It's easier to make apps than it has been in the past, but also there's all this data and data tracking that's happening. There's the quantified self, the idea that you can basically track everything you do and use that data to make you fitter, better, happier, stronger, et cetera, et cetera.
Does it work?
Well, it sort of depends. Wearables are something that the tech industry is really excited about. You've got your Fitbit, your Nike Fuel Band.
Those are the things
Jawbone.
That track my steps.
Yep, they track your steps. They might even track your sleep. They track your heart rate. They track all these different things. And they seem to work if you're consistent with them. And they actually give you access to these huge amounts of data that we haven't really had before as regular folks, right? And so the idea is that you can use that data to actually make yourself a better person, of course. The problem with wearables is that these are separate devices. You have to charge them. You have to buy them. Sometimes they only work with the iPhone. Sometimes they only work with Android. And they have, you know, these issues where you might buy one and for 2 weeks you might use it and then it might collect dust for a couple weeks.
So this is a little bit like a digital gym membership. It's only as good as your willpower.
Exactly. And I think that it's probably fair to say that apps are similar. I think maybe what we should do is play with this app that we've both downloaded. It's called the 100 Push-Up app.
Let's try out today's program.
Today's program. Okay. It's week one, day one.
Week one. Okay. How many push-ups are we trying?
Well, this looks like we're trying a bunch of different sets, so it looks like about 12. Are we ready? Are you ready to try and do this? I haven't done a push-up in a while. What do you think?
I do yoga, but, you know, push-ups are not my forte. I got my Marketplace water bottle.
That might be of use for both of us.
Okay.
All right, let's do it.
Let's do some push-ups.
All right, I'm going to hit start. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay. We're done.
Okay.
We're done. Two push-ups.
Okay.
Not bad.
All right.
Not bad.
All right. We're resting.
You're resting. We only have 9 more to go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Good form, Ben. Good form. 1, 2.
Okay.
Okay. Done.
Okay.
1. Two.
Ooh. Ready?
Okay, good form.
Go.
Good form. 1. Oh, God. 2. 1.
Oh,
this is 3. 2. 1 more. 3.
Okay. I don't
think
my form is very good.
We're done.
We're done.
Okay. High fives for sure.
Whew.
Okay. So now we have the option to update Facebook or we could update Twitter.
I don't want Facebook to know that.
I know.
I don't either. This tired.
I don't either. Next time we do this, can we do this, like,
maybe on a day that's not 85 degrees?
Yeah, it's warm. It's a warm September. It's a warm September.
Please
and
don't
there's
sing.
Reason to
Please
believe.
Please don't sing. Don't
maybe
sing.
Maybe this year.
Don't sing.
Okay.
Would you like the app to remind you to do this again tomorrow?
Would I like it to? I think it would be good if it did.
Do you need the app to remind you to do this again tomorrow?
Ooh. If I'm going to do push-ups in this way, I think I probably do.
With all of this data out there about running or heartbeats, a lot of it very intimate, some of it healthcare related, how does all of this stay private? And should I be worried about that as a user?
I'm not sure you should be worried about it, but you should be engaged with it. You should know what apps you've opted into. You should know what your settings are. You should go into your settings section of your phone and look at the settings for individual apps. You should
so I know what goes up into the cloud or whatever.
Yep, and okay. what goes up and what comes down and what's sort of being used and what's being collected on you and where that stuff is going. And you should at least be engaged as a user with your own understanding of what that is.
Why does a big company like Apple get to decide essentially what apps are out there, what kind of stuff I can and can't track?
Apple is different than Android, right? Apple makes more stringent rules in terms of the apps that are allowed on something like their health tracking platform, something like their app store. Android, you know, there's less rules when it comes to Android applications. But at the end of the day, it's about money, right? Apple wants its devices, its software to be effective. It wants its users to keep using that software. And so it wants some control. Android, maybe less so. But once again, how your application deals with your data is something that the application builder really wants control over because it has an impact on how often you use the app.
Work it, make it, do it. Makes us all better, faster, stronger.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you.
All right, same time tomorrow. 20 push-ups. What do you think?
I guess so. I know I got to be right now, because I can't get much stronger. Man, I've been waiting all night now. That's how long I've been on ya. Working harder, making better. I need you right now. I need you right now. Let's get lost tonight. You could be my black Kate Moss tonight. Play secretary on the ball tonight. And you don't give a what they all say, right? Awesome, the Christian and Christian Dior. Damn, they don't make them like this anymore. I ask, cause I'm not sure. Do anybody make real anymore? Bow in the presence of greatness. Cause right now, that has forsaken us. You should be honored by my lateness. That I would even show up to this place. So go ahead, go nuts, go ace. Especially in my pastel on my page. Act like you can't tell who made this new gospel, homie, take six. Get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app on Google Play or in the iTunes Store. And there's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Now we've got a story that I think tells us something about our psychology and need for control, about the environments we pay to create for who and what we love. The money Americans spend on their pets is at an all-time high. That's according to the American Pet Products Association, which estimates that pet spending will top $58.5 billion this year. That's more money than Congress spends on NASA. And individually, people spend more money on their pets than they do on beer or going to the movies. We wanted to put this pet splurge in context, so we headed over to D Pet Hotel in the Chelsea neighborhood here in New York.
We're in the lobby, and one cool thing about the lobby is that we try to create as much transparency as we can. So you'll see lots of windows where people can see into the space and watch the dogs play.
That's Carrie Brown, the co-owner of D Pet Hotel, and she says this hotel has all the amenities of a hotel for people, including a workout room.
We do have a gym here called Pant Gym, where dogs can get personal training time with a trainer. So part of that is dog treadmills, where they can get workouts. We play Rocky music, we rock it out, you know? So our Uber suites are this way. And our Uber suites are, like, nicer than my bedroom at home. They have full-size beds, 42-inch flat-screen TVs. Ike is staying in this one, and we have not yet made his bed. But they are as nice as my apartment at home.
Okay, this is, what, 10 by...
It's a 12 by 12
12
bedroom.
By 12.
Each of them comes with a full-size bed, 42-inch flat-screen TV, basically all the comforts of a bedroom at home.
Do they know if the TV is on?
You know what? Actually, a lot of parents say that they leave their radio or a TV on just to keep their dog company when they're away. So it actually is a lot like home when
wow.
we have those on.
Okay.
Some other cool things about our space, and actually Ike, the dog staying in the Uber suite right now, we offer chef services as well. So we have a private chef who creates different meals for dogs. So he'll get brown rice, vegetables, and Ike's choice of meat, so beef, turkey, chicken, what have you. So he'll get fresh meals made each day. We also have raw food meals as well. There's a lot of dogs here, especially in New York City, that are on raw food diets, so we offer that as well. We also offer chauffeur services. So we have some dogs
who saw that.
Maybe from, you know, the Upper East Side or what have you, and need transportation down here. So we partner with different chauffeur services here in the area to give them a ride of luxury to our hotel.
Do people really book, like, a Bentley to drive their dog around?
They do, yes. Particularly oh. in our Los Angeles location, we have Ferraris, Lamborghinis who actually pick up dogs. Here in New York City, yes, it's more of the black car, the, you know, the Bentley, that sort of thing. But yes, people do use that service.
Do you think the dog can tell?
Can I not answer that? You know what, I think our client treats their dog like it's their child, or it's like a member of their family. And we see dogs that way as well. So we want to offer the very best for dogs here in the city. And that is what Pant Gym is for. That's what the Uber Suite's for. That's what our driving service is for. All that stuff is to just create the best of the best experience for your dog.
Let's go upstairs. Let's talk a little more.
Sweet, but she gets in that park and she gets so amped up
yeah.
that it just creates problems for everyone.
How did this business start? How did the idea begin?
A friend of mine in Los Angeles had started this business about 5 years ago. And as my partners and I started learning about this business, we thought, wow, what a great concept to bring to Manhattan. So we started about 2 years ago here, and it's been so exciting since.
You know, we went downstairs, you know, we looked at some of these rooms, and I'm thinking, okay, more than $100 a night. I think if you said that to someone, they might have a hard time wrapping their mind around that price for a dog.
Our services are very unique. Our services are for that person who treats their dog like it's their child, like it's their family member. And with that, they want the very best for their dog. And we offer that. We offer suites instead of cages or kennels. We offer private driving services or workouts for your dog to keep them as healthy as possible. We offer a very clean, safe environment with people who have a ton of experience with dogs. So we offer the very best of the best services.
I notice you use the word parent, not owner. What do you think that says about the way Americans feel about their pets?
I think you're dead on. So yes, we consider our dogs our clients or our guests. And yes, the owners as parents, because that's what they are. Their dog is their child. And so we treat them as such. We make sure that when a parent requests that the dog gets playtime with a certain dog, or they get certain meal requests or what have you, we do that. Just like if you were taking your kid to school or the playground, if you had requests, we do the same thing here.
But you know there are people who are going to say, but come on, it's not a kid.
There will be people who do that, but our client is not that way, and we don't see dogs as that way. Dogs are like members of our family, members of our community, and we treat them as such.
When you think about your business and where it's going, do you see this as something that is growing, that is a market that you're going to tap into?
Deep Head Hotels seems like such a luxurious,
yeah.
lavish sort of service, but it's actually very practical here in New York City. For those people who work a ton, who play a ton, who travel lots, this is a phenomenal solution to their challenge of finding someone who will treat their dog just like they would. And we do that.
Run me through the prices. Let's say day boarding, basic overnight, fancy overnight.
Sure. So our most basic suite is called the Standard Suite. It comes with a little Coranda dog bed as well as a flat screen TV. It's a really great accommodation for your dog. That is $84 per night. It includes 24 hours of care. So it includes, you know, daycare that day as well. The Sensational Suite is $120 per night. It's a nice upgrade from the Standard. And then the Uber Suite, which is our most luxurious suite. It has a full-size bed, 42-inch flat-screen TV. Those are $200 per night.
How many dogs do you think you have in here right now?
We have, in total, between 40 and 50 right now. And that includes daycare, boarding, and grooming.
Doesn't any of this ever blow your mind and you got to say, come on?
It's just fun, you know? People have dogs to be their friends. It's man's best friend, right? They're their companions. They're their friends. You want the best of the best for your dog. So it's a really fun market to be in.
Carrie Brown, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming.
And that brings us to the weekend number. $875. That's the average amount dog owners spend on their four-legged loved ones. That's according to the ASPCA. The Animal Advocacy Group says that just two decades ago, owners spent about $17 billion a year on their pets. That's about $43 billion less than pet owners are expected to dole out next year. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. This week, we asked our community, listeners and online, about how you save money on groceries. And here's what you had to say.
Hi, my name is Liz, and I'm from Arlington, Massachusetts. My tip for hacking grocery stores is don't go shopping when you're hungry. It's the number one rule in our house.
Hey, Marketplace. This is Dylan in San Francisco. My grocery store tip is to pull from the back of the shelf for things like bread, meat, poultry, and eggs. Most people pull from the front, which is where stores stock the items that will expire the soonest. So pulling from the back is a great way to buy you a few more days or even up to a week of shelf life.
Hello, my name is Janae Adams. If you're truly trying to save on groceries, have a common list of grocery items that you buy every month for your household. And then find the store or stores that offer those items for the best price. Now, if you stay with what is usual for your household, you will save hundreds, even thousands of dollars a year in groceries. Go for the inexpensive food items, and that those items will allow you to make meals that will leave you with multiple nights of leftovers. Take, for example, spaghetti. When we were paying off $48,000 in 2.5 years, we ate a lot of spaghetti. And my last tip is, everyone knows not to go to the grocery store hungry, but just in case you find yourself getting hungry while you're at the grocery store, go to the produce or the cheese section where there are always samples to eat. Eat a couple to help you get through the rest of the grocery trip, and you still won't overspend.
In part, we asked because the cost of food is rising. You might really notice it if you buy meat. The drought has really pushed prices up by more than 9% this year. But we also heard from a lot of you who just like to exercise control over your grocery bills. It's like clocking your own personal victory. Kristen Wong shares that passion. She's a personal finance writer for 2 Cents, Life Hacker, and Brokopedia. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you.
Do not shop hungry seems to be common. But there's also some stuff about, you know, looking for discounted items, things that can stretch. I'm curious what your tips are on saving for groceries.
Yeah, I think the looking for things that stretch is a really good tip. I like Janae's tip about having kind of a grocery list that you follow each week. I call that my backup grocery list because sometimes I'm too lazy to meal plan. So I have like a backup grocery list in my phone. So that's like beans and lentils, of course. It's like the frugal go-to. you know, rice, tofu, mushrooms are usually on my list, potatoes, sweet potatoes. A lot of saving money on groceries is just not wasting food. You know, we waste, as a country as a whole, we waste like hundreds of billions of dollars worth of food each year. Harvard did a study on that last year, is where I got that figure from. They released a study, at least. Their point was that a lot of it is based on bad expiration dates. So, you know, not that I don't follow the expiration dates, but there's a cool website that I like to use for that called eatbydate.com. And they tell you the, quote, true expiration dates of different foods.
So, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, you know, of course you don't want to eat spoiled food, but we're kind of on the other extreme where we're throwing away so much perfectly good food. And that can be a big waste of money.
You've written about shopping as a child in Asian grocery stores with your mom, and I think you have also talked about other unorthodox places to look for deals. Tell me about those.
Yeah, you know, my mom, we're Chinese, so my mom called it the Chinese store. We would go to the Hong Kong food market. It's kind of hit or miss because some stuff I've noticed, it might depend on your location too, but here in LA I've found that there's some stuff that's actually more expensive when I go to the, you know, ethnic markets or whatever you want to call them. Some of the things that I find are cheaper at the, what my mom would call the Chinese store, are produce items usually.
There's often a tension between nutrition and rock-bottom price. How do you navigate that?
I think that that's actually a myth. A lot of people say that healthy eating healthier is more expensive. I don't find that to be true. I think there are, like those staples that I mentioned, mushrooms, lentils, beans, rice, those things are usually not that pricey. They're cheaper than the prepackaged meals you get. Anything that you cook fresh is usually going to be cheaper. And you can.
So it just takes planning?
It just takes meal planning, yeah. And those things you can freeze when they're on sale and then use them at a, you know, buy them when they're on sale and they're in season and then freeze them and then use them at a later date.
There's also a lot of pretty cool technology that you have written about. Walk me through some of the stuff that's out there. Some of this really blew my mind.
Well, yeah, that's my favorite thing. It's kind of just using tech to automate my grocery savings so I don't have to think about it too much. I'll just start with this website called Supercook that I am a big fan of. I don't know why it's not more popular. I've been using it all the time for the past 2 years. And which is when I discovered it. And you know how people say, like, oh, to save money on groceries, you should Iron Chef your leftovers, which is basically taking all of the leftovers you have from the week and just coming up with a crazy meal based on those leftovers, which is really fun. But I'm not creative when it comes to that stuff. So I use Supercook, and you can put your ingredients in there, tell them what you have in your pantry, your kitchen, your refrigerator, and they will give you a list of meals that you can make with just those ingredients. It's pretty cool. And then there is an app called Locavore that I think is pretty cool. It tells you what produce is in season and likely to be on sale.
There is an aspect to this grocery hacking, if you want to call it that, that doesn't seem just to be about money. I feel like people almost get a little high, like it's a scavenger hunt when they do this successfully. What do you think that's about?
I don't know. I think it's just human nature. It's like our hunting instinct, you know? It's so, you know, we don't have to hunt anymore, maybe. So when we find a good deal, we feel like we accomplished something. I don't know. At least that's what it feels like to me, because I do get a little bit of a rush when I find something that's a really good deal and I feel like I need to tell everybody about it. But but I guess that's where it comes from. It's just, you know, this small feeling of accomplishment.
What is out there that you're not a fan of? I gather you are not a coupon clipper.
You know, I used to be a coupon clipper, and everybody kind of like in the like personal finance blogging community, it seems like it's very much divided between people who like to do these super frugal things like coupon clipping and then people who are like very much against it and think it's a complete waste of time, which I understand, because being frugal is about valuing your time too. So you don't want to do things that take up so much of your time that's not worth it. So if you watch like extreme couponers, I spend 40 hours a week clipping coupons, and yeah, you save $100 on groceries, but is that really worth your time?
Kristen Wong is a personal finance writer for 2 Cents, Brokopedia, and Life Hacker. Thanks for sharing your grocery hacks.
Well, thank you so much.
Next week, the cost of elder care continues to rise, along with the numbers of people needing it. You taking care of an older relative or getting ready?
We want to know how you're managing. Tell us at MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We want to hear your story. It for this week's Marketplace Weekend. Next week, the show is hitting the road. We're going to be in Portland, Oregon. We're going to have some brunch and, as always, hear the stories about how your life intersects with the economy. And we're going to talk about the difficult financial and emotional question of how you get ready to take care of someone you love who's getting older. It can be tough, and we're going to help you through it. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament, Raghu Manavalan, and John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you all next weekend. Thanks for listening. This is APM.